You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, July 12th, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, author Eleanor Cleghorn, author of Unwell Women, Misdiagnosis and Myth in a Man-Made World. Also on the program today, unprecedented protests erupting in Cuba. Meanwhile, Joe Biden fires the Trump head of the Social Security Administration. About time. Police hold suspect in the Haitian presidential assassination. New documents show the EPA approved forever chemical PFAS for fracking 10 years ago. U.S. Senate back in session. The fate of the infrastructure bill to be resolved. And as Texas pushes its voter suppression bill, national Dems look to reconfigure voting rights to address most recent Supreme Court rulings. The Afghanistan drawdown is just about complete as the top U.S. general steps down. Biden urged to appoint a third FCC commissioner to restore net neutrality. And lastly, a heartwarming story of a Tennessee teacher about to be fired for assigning a Ta-Nehisi Coates article for reading. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. Sorry, we're running a little bit, a little hectic here back in the office and just working out, slowly rolling in our tech changes. But fortunately, our technology has allowed Emma Vigeland to be here today. Yes. Emma, good to see you.
Yes, good to see you, right? I mean, the audience may not be aware, but I'm one of those holograms like Michael Jackson or Tupac that they put out there. So that's, I would say, what, sometimes 80% of your budget?
That's right. We spend a lot of money bringing in the hologram in here and making it as lifelike as possible. A lot of other shows would just have you show up. But
I'm lazy, so.
But in this instance, it's much easier for all of us involved just to have the hologram produced. Someday we'll be able to market that technology. That's the hope, anyways.
That's what your membership's going towards.
Exactly. Thank you for your support, ladies and gentlemen. It is Monday. Hope everyone is well. We're in the middle of the summer. The Senate is back in session as of today. And there is going to be a mad scramble on the infrastructure. We're going to hear more in the coming days about reporting about the both the bipartisan bill and the reconciliation bill. And all of this is going to come to a head over the next couple of weeks, ladies and gentlemen. And we will have a better sense of of a lot of things, including, I think, what ultimately will be the success or failure of the Biden administration from a legislative perspective. If they fail to get two complete infrastructure bills, it is basically over, I think, at that point. And then hopefully they will get as many judges in as they can until 2022, and then we'll see from there. But we're going to have a much better sense in the next, I would say, 30 days, maybe less.
Yeah, I mean, maybe the self-imposed deadline at the start was, what, the end of July? But it seems like it's going to extend beyond that.
I don't know that this will be done by then, but we will be far enough down the road to know whether this road leads to anywhere. And we have several federal support systems in terms of unemployment and whatnot that are ending at the end of the beginning of September. August is generally there is a another vacation. And so, like I say, we will have a better sense, at least of where we are with all of this by then.
They deserve it.
They deserve it. It's been 2 weeks, and they just got to get back on there. We will get to that story of a teacher who's teaching, let's be clear, a contemporary issues class back in February. Then later in March, he was playing a video of White Privilege, a spoken word poem by Kylie Jenny Lacey. And also, this teacher assigned an essay that was first in the Atlantic magazine, written by Ta-Nehisi Coates, the first white president. And apparently that's enough. That's a firing offense in Tennessee.
I remember that. I remember that essay, which purely because I remember it, you should fire me.
Well, what is amazing is the outcry that we would hear about college campuses that people have been protesting and somehow prevented the Student Activities Council for supporting, you know, Milo Yiannopoulos or Ben Shapiro from showing up. Yet when we're actually talking about a public school where a contemporary issues teacher assigns a Ta-Nehisi Coates article, and with all due respect to Ta-Nehisi Coates, this isn't the most radical of radical writings.
No.
But even if it was.
I wish it was. I wish it was a little bit more radical than Ta-Nehisi Coates.
But regardless, I mean, the idea that this is grounds for firing. You know, this is the thing, is that there are news stories that go on every day. And, you know, this has been from, I want to say time immemorial, but time immemorial when it comes to cable news, right? Like 15 years ago, I was on CNN arguing with somebody, the male president of the Concerned Women for America at the time, about the existence of the war on Christmas. And he cited some school in Wisconsin where they changed the name like of Silent. They took Jesus out of the song Silent Night. Now, apparently they had done that like 20 years earlier or something like that. It was just a different tune, whatever it was. And that existed. It was real. But was it catching a phenomena that was existing? If you hype that, understand that you're building a narrative in media circles. And also know how all this works in this country. There is an existing power dynamic. And so the idea that the salience of one guy on cable television saying that there's an anti-white agenda, like Tucker Carlson, for instance, there's an anti-white bias in this country versus hundreds of students saying this in a college. Well, even if you were to put 100 students in one college and 100 students in the other, we have history in this country. We have an existing power structure. You need to assess what constitutes news and what constitutes an actual danger to society based upon those contexts. The history of this country, the structure of this country, where the wealth lies, all of it. And to divorce yourself from those realities and claim that one threat is as much as another threat is completely blinkered. I'm sorry. Like, you know, it's just, there's a difference between a, you know, if you have kids under 10 and you have a window open on the first floor, it's different than having kids under 10 with a window open on the 10th floor.
Well, I mean, it's also just, incredibly important to understand that it's a part of a larger project of one, completely concealing those power dynamics, and two, making things like this Tennessee story possible because this is a part of a mobilizing effort by conservatives with this critical race theory stuff. Because if you're involved in your local school board, then you're certainly more likely to be involved in your state house races, and you're more likely to be supporting Republican candidates in those races, and then it works up on its way up to Congress and on in governorships, and that's a bit of like the mobilizing of the troops on the ground here. This is a part of a political project, not a news one, and so that false equivalency is very instrumental.
Yep. Meanwhile, I didn't mean to start off the show that way, but that's the way it works around here occasionally. CPAC happened this weekend. That is where all the lunatics in the country go for a weekend to say hi to each other and network. Hey, look at this innovation I have in insanity. Well, let me top that with this innovation in my insanity. And then they get together
synergize the insanity.
They synergize. Here is Anthony Fauci, not as used to CPAC, I imagine, as most of us who are in this business where we watch it every year in the same way that you would, like,
not used to being a central figure at CPAC at the very least.
Right. It's sort of like
a subject of conversation.
But, like, you know, it's like, I don't know, the first time you see penguins walk up onto the beach or something like that, the March of the Penguins. But if you work in that industry, you know, like
the March of the Fascists.
It just happens. Well, yeah, here it is. Here is Anthony Fauci watching a clip about vaccination, and he is horrified. Remember, we now know that while the Delta variant can be responsible for breakthrough infections, in terms of hospitalizations and deaths, it is about as close to as you're not quite 100% safe, but you're close to about 95-98% safe from hospitalization or death if you are vaccinated. And here is Anthony Fauci watching people shower and bathe and swim in just pure ignorance.
And potentially COVID.
And
to do with politics. It's a public health issue. It doesn't matter who you are. The virus doesn't know whether you're a Democrat, a Republican, or an independent. For sure, we know that. And yet there is that divide of people wanting to get vaccinated and not wanting to get vaccinated, which is really unfortunate because it's losing lives.
The conservative political conference, CPAC, is going on this weekend. I want to play for you a clip of one of the speakers from that event yesterday.
They were hoping, the government was hoping, that they could sort of sucker 90% of the population into getting vaccinated. And it isn't happening, right? There's a younger people.
I'm going to cut him off right there because he just goes on to just say things that are not true about the vaccine. But what I wanted to get your reaction to is the crowd cheering when this gentleman talks about how the government was not able to achieve a 90% vaccine goal. The crowd cheers. As a public health official, what's your reaction when you hear that?
It's horrifying. I mean, they're cheering about someone saying that it's a good thing for people not to try and save their lives. I mean, if you just unpack that for a second, Jake, it's almost frightening to say, hey, guess what? We don't want you to do something to save your life. Yay! Everybody starts screaming and clapping. I just don't get that. I mean, I don't think that anybody who's thinking clearly can get that. What is that all about? I don't understand that, Jake.
On the other side of the political spectrum, the former health.
Yeah, Jake has no answer for that because he doesn't want to say.
That was Alex Berenson, by the way, who The Atlantic wrote a piece on him called The Pandemic's Wrongest Man. I would encourage people to read it because he's been wrong every single step of the way when it comes to the pandemic in predictions and just in science that he purports.
And he seems to shift a little bit, too. He's sort of like one of those guys who are like, one time at when I play 21, I'm always going to hit on 13, and then I'm always going to not hit on 13.
Well, you know, when you're trying to pretend to be calling shots, you've got to cover your bases by calling every shot.
There you go. All right, we got to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Eleanor Cleghorn on her book, Unwell Women, Misdiagnosis and Myth in a Man-Made World. We'll be right back. Folks, today's program is sponsored by honey. At least in part.
We were just talking about this.
We were just talking about this because Matt was like, apparently we had a monitor that like melted, supposedly. I don't know. Matt has some very big requirements for monitors these days. Like he's got, we got like a huge, like, what is that? Like a 75 inch monitor that we have over there that's curved and
ultra wide curved screen. Yep.
Ultra wide curved screen. And it also gives Matt a massage during the thing. Anyways, so he claims that one of the other monitors that apparently wasn't up to snuff for him was melted. I went on line. I got, I looked for a monitor and boom, honey pops up. And in this instance, it didn't have a coupon for me, but it did say, ooh. Wait a second, the price has had a big increase. And so we were like, wait a second, maybe we should check for another one. And then I found one that had a price decrease.
Whoa.
Yep. And that's the thing. Honey supports over 30,000 stores online, ranges from sites that have tech and gaming products to popular fashion brands, even food delivery. So here's how it goes. You're shopping on one of your favorite sites. When you check out, the honey button drops down. You don't have to do anything. It drops down and it says, we'll apply coupons. Click. They search over, like, I don't know, sometimes it's 3-5 different coupons. If one works, they plug it in. Or if there are no coupons, they tell you price drop, price rise, all this. They found over 17 million members, over $2 billion in savings. Every, well, me and Milo, let's put it that way. Saul doesn't buy stuff online. But we got honey on our computers, and it gives me the peace of mind of knowing, A, that there's no worse feeling than thinking, like, is there a coupon out there to save you a couple bucks? For me, anyways. And so even when honey says there's no coupons, I'm like, okay, at least I'm not leaving money on the table. Look, if you don't already have honey, you could be straight up missing out on free savings. It's literally free. And it installs in a few seconds. And by getting it, you're going to be doing yourself a solid and you'll be supporting the podcast. You know, I would never recommend anything I don't use. You get honey for free at joinhoney.com/majority. That's joinhoney.com/majority. Speaking of something that I do use. Came in today, told everybody, got some extra liquid IV. People can stock up. Today, for me, I even brought down one of these things. I got a watermelon.
Oh, not matcha today.
Not matcha. Nope. I even mixed it up a little bit. Hot summer months are here. Got to be proactive. Got to keep yourself hydrated. One stick of liquid IV in 16 ounces of water hydrates faster and more efficiently than water alone. Plus, it tastes great with flavors like watermelon, strawberry, and lemon and lime. I don't know. I don't know why they don't like your acai.
Oh, God.
Maybe these are
acai.
Summer.
Acai.
Acai. I don't know.
I know.
Liquid IV contains 5 essential vitamins, has more vitamin C than an orange, as much potassium as a banana. It's healthier than those sugary sports drinks. There are no artificial flavors or preservatives and less sugar than an apple. Liquid IV is powered by cellular transport technology. The optimal ratio of glucose, sodium, and potassium delivers water and nutrients right into the bloodstream. The company has donated over 4 million servings in response to COVID-19. Products are being donated to hospitals, first responders, food banks, and more. You know, I mean, I've told you multiple times. Generally, almost every day, I am full on matcha. because that is my coffee substitute. There are times I mix it up a little bit. If I've been drinking too much, I have liquid IV. If I'm taking a trip, I'm worried about, getting a plane, I take a couple of packets with me.
Life hack, if you have been drinking that night, drink it right before bed.
Yes.
You feel much better in the morning.
Yep. And also, it's been hot and I want to stay hydrated. And sometimes I'll do it before I even think about it, which is good. I'm like planning ahead. Grab your liquid IV in bulk nationwide at Costco, or you can get 25% off when you go to liquidiv.com. Use the code MAJORITYREP at checkout. It's 25% off anything you order when you get better hydration today using promo code MAJORITYREP at liquidiv.com. And lastly, I got some fruit growing this year, folks. I got an Arkansas black apple tree that is performing exceptionally. And I have two, I think it's called Hosni Korean pears trees. They're big, big. They look like apples. What? How is that possible, Sam? Didn't you just tell us you got those trees last year? Yes, that is true. I got them during COVID. But the beauty of fastgrowingtrees.com is that they send you trees that are like
fast growing.
The fact of the matter is they're already big. That's the bottom line. Trees go like this, like this, like this, and then they're like people. They just shoot up. And you get closer to the point where they're shooting up. And they send them right to you. You can skip the big box stores. You head to fastgrowingtrees.com, the world's largest online nursery. And you can get trees, fruit trees. You can get shrubs. You can get plants for your home. You don't have to wait in lines. You don't have to mess up your car. It doesn't matter. You can be looking for shade trees, privacy trees, fruit trees, like I said, or just added color for your yard. Every plant is shipped with a well-developed root system. That's the key, folks. You can put it in the ground, but if it dies, what's the point? You got to wait a whole year to do it again. Planting season is here. Join over 1 million satisfied gardeners at fastgrowingtrees.com. Plus, the 30-day Alive and Thrive guarantee means your plants will arrive happy, healthy, and ready for planting. Now through July 31st, go to fastgrowingtrees.com/majority for 15% off. That's 15% off at fastgrowingtrees.com/majority. fastgrowingtrees.com/majority. I can get maybe one of those red maple trees. That's what I'm looking for. All right. Want to welcome to the program Eleanor Cleghorn. She is the author of Unwell Women, Misdiagnosis and Myth in a Man-Made World. Welcome to the program, Eleanor. I'm here with Emma Vigeland.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let's start with your own personal story that led you to look into this, which is basically a history of a dynamic in medicine, which has been not good for women, I guess is really the best way to put it. Tell us about your own story and how you came to decide to write the book.
Yeah, of course. So in 2010, I was diagnosed with an autoimmune disease called lupus. And it's a disease that affects 90% more women and people born female than men. And I was diagnosed with it after I developed a life-threatening heart condition and was rushed to the emergency room. The heart condition was very mysterious, and I just had my second baby, who also coincidentally had a heart condition while I was pregnant. And it turned out that both of these conditions were being caused by my own immune system, which was mounting in response and actually attacking the function of first my unborn baby's heart and secondly my heart. So I was given a diagnosis by a rheumatologist who's a specialist in autoimmune diseases and really knows how to kind of piece through all the symptoms and what kind of blood work to ask for. But generally speaking, there's not a lot of knowledge, of consistent knowledge in general medical practice about autoimmunity and how to diagnose it. Lupus ordinarily takes between 4 and 6 years to be conclusively diagnosed. So in this respect, from when I first got really sick to when I was diagnosed, it was pretty fast. But actually, for about 7 years before my diagnosis, I'd been having what I now know are the characteristic symptoms of lupus. So these include joint pain, migraines, photosensitivity, so being sensitive to the sunlight, mental health issues, I think, associated with being in a lot of pain. And whenever I went to the doctor, invariably I was dismissed as either being anxious or hormonal, or one doctor suggested I might be pregnant and not realize it. Another tried to diagnose me with gout. And this kind of went on and on, this just general sort of disbelief, diminishment, dismissal of my pain. So, I mean, really, I had an underlying disease, but I was never referred for any diagnostic tests. The pain was never taken seriously enough to be seen as an indicator of something else that was going on. And so the book really came from a realization that this experience I'd had was a profoundly gendered one. And I started to look through medicine's history as a way to sort of come to terms with my, not just my illness, but also the lack of kind of understanding around what autoimmunity is, why it affects more women than men, you know, why it's so unpredictable. I was a history researcher at the time that I was diagnosed, looking into feminist histories of art. So this was kind of my impulse anyway, to look back to try and understand where we are now. And I came across all these women in case studies, textbooks, you know, and crossed the annals of medicine over, you know, a century, 2 centuries, 3 centuries. And there was something so familiar in their experiences that I thought, well, okay, you know, medical science has progressed exponentially, you know, but yet our medical attitudes towards women's bodies, especially towards women's pain, especially towards illness symptoms that aren't maybe immediately diagnosable, hasn't really moved on much at all. So that was really the impetus for me to tell this story of why a woman like me and, you know, thousands, hundreds of thousands, possibly millions of others were experiencing, you know, sort of degrees of medical neglect, degrees of medical mistreatment. And I just wanted to really go back to the beginning of medical history and sort of build this story of how we got to where we are today.
I mean, and it really, when you see it in the context of history, it really becomes rather, sort of, I mean, you know, very clear. It really sort of amazing that you could sort of, if you had a time machine, go back in time and almost see the exact same doctor.
pretty much.
But with that said, how do you, and then I want to talk about that history, but how do you, when you had that realization that it was gendered, like, how do you, like, what is the counterfactual? Had you gone in as a man, and I'm talking prior to the pregnancy, right? For those 7 or 8 years, like, and it, I mean, it's absurd that they never said, like, hey, you know, this has been going on for like 2 or 3 years or 4 years or 5 years or 6 years. Maybe we should take the next step. What, like, but how do you, as you come to that realization that it's gendered, how do you make that, you know, what, how do you formulate that counterfactual? Had you gone in there and you were a man?
I think there are a couple of things working against women when they go to the doctor's office, which was something that when I was first diagnosed became a kind of anecdotal or intuitive realization, because I was diagnosed and then, you know, I would talk about this experience with female friends or relatives and there would be invariably some kind of similar experience. Oh yeah, doctors don't listen. You know, I went through awful menopause symptoms, doctors didn't listen. I actually had undiagnosed heart disease, doctors didn't listen. So it became more of this kind of intuitive sense that women just generally are disbelieved, you know, societally are, tend to be disbelieved, underestimated and taken less seriously, especially when they speak about their bodies. I mean, I could see this if I didn't know necessarily at the time how systemic and ingrained this was within medicine. I was certainly very aware of it, you know, systemically and culturally and socially and other ways. I mean, now, you know, bias studies into medical gender bias that have been conducted over the last sort of 20 years since this issue has really started coming, pushing through, have shown that it's not necessarily to do with biological sex that is set against us, but it's to do with the way that gendered expressions of pain and bodily symptoms tend to how they are when they're spoken, how seriously they're taken. So men, not all men, of course, but men tend to express pain and things that are going on in their bodies in a much more straightforwardly descriptive way. And of course, men do tend to go to the doctor less if they have a worry about their bodies and pain. They don't tend to speak about it as much. But when they do, studies have shown that men tend to be very descriptive. So it might be like, I have a pain here. It's been painful for 2 weeks. And that method of speaking, that method of kind of straightforward sort of testimony really stands in people's favor when they want to be perceived as being legitimate. Women, again, not all women, tend to feminize their expressions of bodily pain. So if a woman goes to a doctor's office and speaks about a pain that might have been, thwarting her for months or years, maybe, she might tend to express that pain in a more social, more sort of psychological and emotional context, in how it might affect her loved ones, how it might affect her work, her relationships, her getting the kids to school, however that might manifest. And that sort of narrativizing, almost sort of storytelling around it, is stacked against women. So we are perceived as less legitimate because of the way that we relate to pain, So I think as a man, it's difficult, isn't it, to tell, but certainly anecdotally, I've heard that men do tend to have their pain more, rapidly and sort of seriously responded to. And there are certainly studies that have been done that, bear this out.
And we should say, and I think what the history makes it clear too, is that probably a big reason why the responses to those expressions have disparate reactions is a function of the sensibility that has dominated the medical providers, so that it's what they're responding to, and they associate the description of pain basically because it has been a male dominated profession. And so it really is just like, it's easier for me to empathize with a guy because I know what a guy talks like. And so I know what you're saying. The other thing sounds like he just got some.
Sounds hysterical.
Sounds a little hysterical.
Yeah. About that a bit too, because I think, you in your book, you talk a little bit about some of these this coded language in history, right? Like hysteria, even going back to the days of witchcraft and stuff. And I think it's also important to note that in terms of the data that you're citing, there's also a heavily racialized component as well, where black women specifically, when you look into statistics in terms of pain assessment, they are not perceived as empathetically by doctors. And there's a kind of a vein of science around it. So no, it can't be. There's no way that this could be influenced by our own perspectives, right? We're coming at this from a scientific method. And so there's an arrogance that's associated with that, which is a roundabout way of me asking you about kind of endometriosis, which you write about, which is a long, painful history for women in terms of forced sterilization and just historically that being misdiagnosed. If you could talk about that within the context of your book.
Course. And endometriosis now is, I always think, a really sort of woeful example of how medicine has failed women across its history. And we've now inherited this legacy today where we have, 1 in 10 women and people with uteruses are estimated to have endometriosis. It's a major cause of infertility. It takes up to 10 years to be diagnosed in the US and in the UK too. It's very difficult to treat, and knowledge, clear, accurate knowledge about endometriosis and what is the best pathway and treatments for that disease are very muddled. As you mentioned, hysterectomy is often touted as a cure, but it isn't a cure for endometriosis. But what is happen with endometriosis is the symptoms, or the major symptoms, because it has many different symptoms, but the major symptoms associated with menstrual pain, with menstrual bleeding, these have been symptoms of, associated with the sort of failures and the sort of irregularities and mysteries of the female body for centuries. So they've got a very long association of sort of myths being ascribed to them about how the female body is just sort of naturally defective because of its sort of quote unquote normal female functions. And endometriosis, although the symptoms, we can see the symptoms being documented really thoroughly throughout the history of medicine, from, you know, the classical ancient authors until, you know, right up through, you know, developments in surgical diagnostic procedures. You know, we can see also some of these mythologies and how much sticking power they have had. So, for example, endometriosis got its name in the 1920s. And when more research was being done into what the disease actually was. And when this disease was first named, there was a lot of really promising research into it. But then one of the major physicians, an American guy called Joseph Meeks, he came in and he did these broader studies on it. And he decided that it was predominantly a disease that affected white, sort of career-minded younger women, sort of, you know, 18-odd. And he decided that the cure for endometriosis was to, you know, procreate vigorously and often until you hit menopause and you couldn't do it anymore. And this has really stuck, you know, this idea that it's predominantly white women who get endometriosis, that it's predominantly an illness of women who are child-free, you know, who put off childbearing, has stuck. I mean, and it's obscured, you know, this mythologizing has really obscured research into endometriosis to the point where now, you know, we've gone through since the 40s when this guy was making his theories, you know, we've had incredible advances in medical diagnosis, yet we're still parroting the same language around who gets endometriosis, what kind of person gets it, and what we should do to cure it. And it wasn't really until the 70s that endometriosis was even identified as a disease that could affect Black women, which is appalling because you think about, you know, how much just hasn't been researched, how much information and data just has not been gathered. So, yeah, endometriosis, I think, is really a sort of error example of these failings.
And we should say, though, too, I mean, it's not, you can't see from the outside if someone's experiencing endometriosis if the tissue is growing on the outside of the uterus. And it's incredibly painful. And so a lot of the dynamics that you're describing about how it's more generalized and it's more, I feel this way, you know, it's affecting me in terms of my fertility in ways that may not be necessarily pinpoint, you can point to it. It really does, I think, envelop a lot of the dynamics that you're talking about.
I think that's completely true, because before a disease can be, you know, diagnosed and treated, you sort of first have to kind of run the gauntlet almost of being, of having those symptoms that you report to your doctor, to your GP, taken seriously as evidence of an underlying disease. And you know, we can see that symptoms like menstrual pain, like bodily pain, you know, these symptoms that are more sort of, that carry these, that are weighed down by these, you know, medical myths about women's relationship to pain. You can see how diagnosis is so prolonged and delayed, because women have first got that job of convincing their healthcare provider that these symptoms are not just, you know, the inevitable consequences of having a female body, but actually evidence that something else, something really serious is going on.
Let's go back to, well, close to the beginning, I guess, and talk about wandering womb, which is, I mean, you know, on one hand, it's sort of like, what? And then on the other hand, it's like, okay, that was a long time ago. I mean, was there, tell us what wandering womb is, or what was believed to be, but what also, like, I'm just fascinated to, you know, if we had an author here who tracked specifically men's health, although that would be almost like equivalent on some level, particularly, you know, up until extremely recent times, health, right? I mean, that's part of the problem. But like, was there a, I don't know, a version of wandering womb for, you know, men? Like, oh yeah, we also thought that, like, we had some weird things that we believed about men too at the time. Like, but tell us what wandering womb is.
Of course. So my book begins in ancient Greece, which is the period of medical history that I would sort of mark as the beginnings of what we would now see as our Western evidence-based scientific medical model. So the Hippocratic authors, so this is Hippocrates in the history, they were the first physicians who were writing about the care and treatment of illness in the human body by doing what doctors more or less do now, which is interpreting symptoms, making a diagnosis based on those symptoms, rather than applying sort of religious mysticism or something to knowledge about a person's disease. So the ancient Greeks, while they were bringing, you know, a more sort of considered and thoughtful and symptom-based analysis of illness and health into medical ideas, they also didn't have an awful lot to go on in terms of how they figured out what was actually going on underneath a person's skin. So the ancient Greek physicians were not dissecting. They didn't have, you know, x-rays. They weren't taking temperatures. So they were approximating, and a lot of that approximating was filtered through social and cultural ideas about gender and gender roles in society. So women being predominantly reproductive, or predominantly kind of their main social role being to become pregnant, bear children, and raise children. So it makes sense that in that time in history, that women's diseases would be interpreted primarily through their reproductive capacities. And so the womb being the sort of being the vessel of life, you know, they attributed the womb, the uterus, as the sort of center of women's health and disease. So the healthiest state for a woman to be in, according to the ancient Greek physicians, was pregnant, because the ancient Greek physicians understood bodies in terms of humors, in terms of balances of moisture and heat. And it made sense to them in terms of this, you know, sort of strategy, that when a woman was pregnant, her womb was anchored and moistened. And when it wasn't performing this social duty, it would become dry and go creeping around the body in search of moisture. And as it went creeping about the body in search of moisture, it might, you know, press up against the liver, or, you know, venture nearer to the heart, or even kind of climb up and almost suffocate, you know, the woman. You hear a lot in the ancient medical literature about this thing called suffocation of the womb, which was a sort of convulsive illness that was believed to be because, you know, the uterus was sort of meandering around, having a wander about, looking to kind of find its healthiest state. So it sounds completely outlandish. And actually, in the context of the ancient Greeks, when they were trying to puzzle out, like, why do people get sick? You know, who are men? Who are women? Where does illness come from? What causes it? It's not altogether illogical. But what is illogical is the way that this idea that a womb could meander, that it had appetites and impulses of its own. What's illogical is that then that mythology sticks with us, and it grows throughout the history, you know, it sort of expands and develops across the centuries until we get to the point where women are kind of ruled by their bodies, that they have this almost animal inside them that longs for, you know, intercourse and pregnancy and conception, and therefore that women do not have control over their bodies. So the evolution of that idea becomes illogical, right? It leads us to many of these sort of ideas that shape even today the dynamics between, the gender dynamics between patients and doctors. In terms of men, this is really interesting because men were seen in the ancient Greek physicians' documents as a stable example of a human being. You know, men were the ideal form of a human. You know, their genitalia was outside of their bodies. It could keep nice and cool. They also were out working in fields. They were, you know, creating all the sweat and heat that they needed. Their bodies were in balance and their bodies were stable. So we just don't get that same kind of sort of erratic mythologizing about what's going on under there, because men were seen as these ideals who were sort of exercising their human body in the way it was meant to be exercised, you know, or used.
And it also, I mean, it incentivizes complete sexual dominance and control of the woman if she needs to constantly be pregnant. And also, you know, at that point, she's your property. That serves the man in some way I can't even, you know, articulate fully. But yeah, obviously that's anyway, it's just very convenient and interesting. Go on,
Sam. Yeah, it's also interesting too, because if the male is the control group, then anything that is wrong is problematic. If, you know, pain at that point becomes problematic, because this is a system that's supposed to be working at peak efficiency. And whereas if you set the woman up as being erratic, then obviously, like, oh, well, pain, well, that's just simply part of it. And that takes us all the way.
Having enough sex, or she's well,
yes, but it's the idea being that these symptoms are not indicative of a problem on some level. They're indicative of like normal functioning. For women, and that carried thousands of years up into your diagnosis on some level. Let's move forward in time a little bit. And how did Christianity in the 14th century, how did that add to this sort of already burgeoning, I guess, dynamic where women are essentially their wombs? And everything that comes along with being pregnant is just sort of the norm on some level. And men, I guess, you know, once you've achieved this, once you're the control group, you're the control group, I guess.
I think with the movement of medical knowledge, or the development of medical knowledge from the ancient Greeks into, you know, Christian theology, what you get is, you know, medical discourse survives over the centuries because it's translated and transmitted by men who own knowledge, you know, who own the ability to read, who own the ability to create knowledge. There are little pockets of resistance, of course, but in the main, the people who dominated and owned this knowledge were men. So when the ancient and classical theories about illness were transmitted and translated by Christian theologians, it was also respun with new myths from Christian theology about women not only being other and inferior to men, but also being corruptible and corrupting and polluting and potentially poisonous. Because you have the foundational myth of Eve, of course, of Adam and Eve. You have these foundational myths about women being, or women's bodies specifically, and their sexuality being somehow responsible for the unleashing of sin into the world. You have that in a foundational myth. And so, of course, these foundational myths of Christianity shaped the way that medical knowledge or medical ideas were then respun in light of new religious beliefs. And what's interesting about the 14th century is that we're sort of hovering on the precipice before the witch trials that happened across Europe between the 15th and 17th centuries. And of course, like with any, you know, horrendous events in history, the witch trials didn't just come out of nowhere. You know, there are very complex reasons for these witch trials, but partly it was because there was knowledge set up or knowledge put in place about women's bodies and mind that assumed women to not only be defective, but also highly dangerous or potentially dangerous. And what protected women from the danger sort of embedded in every female body, more or less, was her ascribing to societal and religious norms of marital sex, you know, being very quiet and well-behaved, having many children, not speaking out. You know, these were qualifiers for good health because they were towing domestic and religious ideals. They were towing the line of domestic, societal and religious ideals. And there was, again, some, you know, hugely outrageous theorizing from certain religious kind of pseudo medical writers who talked about how dangerous it was for men to consort with women when, you know, they were menstruating, how dangerous it was to consort with women who had impure thoughts, you know, because they could influence, you know, not only what was going on with the fetus, but also like potentially cause, you know, horrendous contagious diseases, pass on diseases to men. So women took on this kind of, you know, defiling, defective, corrupting nature that they always had to keep in check. You know, the idea in the 14th century is that it's potentially there in all women because all women are potentially sinful. So again, men are the victims of this sin, not the perpetrators. They have to protect themselves from, you know, the defiling and poisonous nature of women. So yeah, it really is a matter of sort of layering, the layering of old learning, old foundational ideas about health and illness with new kind of wilder myths that take that those old foundational ideas and really re-spin them into something that's very punishing. And actually, in the case of, you know, the 14th century, turned out to be exceptionally punishing for women across Europe.
Let's jump ahead to the early 1900s. Because we're entering into a different era of medicine on some level where it's becoming more, I think they would say it's more scientific. And it is on some level. And this horrible story, which I was not aware of James Marion Sims. And I was also not aware that they took down his statue. I don't remember the people protesting in Central Park that we were destroying our history when they did so. But tell us his story and the story of the women who were subjected to this guy.
Of course. So James Marion Sims was a gynecological surgeon who was practicing in the sort of early to mid 19th century. And he was a doctor in Alabama, in a town where 2/3 of the population were enslaved. And he established what he called the first ever women's hospital in his backyard in the town of Montgomery in Alabama. And what this really was an experimental clinic in which James Marion Sims was perfecting gynecological procedures, surgical gynecological procedures, in order to sort of further his reputation and, you know, make his mark on what at that time was a burgeoning professional discipline. You know, gynecology was at that point in the 19th century becoming a serious gentleman's discipline, when before it had just been seen as, you know, bikini medicine or whatever we call it now. So Sims is known today for perfecting a procedure that cures a vaginal fistula, which at the time was a death sentence. It's a horrible injury that can happen after birth, and it causes infection and causes prolapse. And it was pretty much incurable at the time. And because Sims was a physician on the plantations, slave owners would bring women to him who had had difficult, you know, injuries during pregnancy or were unwell after giving birth. And he thought that this horrible injury, this horrible disease was incurable, until he decided that it was permissible to experiment on enslaved young women who were suffering from it, always without anesthetic, until he developed, you know, a procedure that would cure this, that would treat it and put it right. And he experimented on many different victims. And he speaks very egregiously and vaingloriously in his posthumously published autobiography about their pain, about their suffering, about their screams. And it's horrifically hard reading. And the issue is that Sims was lionized as the father of modern American gynecology for a long time, because this procedure he developed for the fistula was life-saving, you know, but the genesis of it was that he was using disempowered women and performing dehumanizing experiments on them until he got this procedure right for the benefit of white women. And he also invented a particular speculum, the duckbill one, or modified the duckbill speculum. So he has these kind of, you know, achievements within gynecological history too. But the horrifying thing is about it is that the achievements of someone like Sims were for a long time completely, you know, they were whitewashed because the history of how he came to make these advances is incredibly harrowing. And it was unfortunately bolstered by racist misbeliefs that Black people, that Black women experience less pain, that they were invulnerable to pain when compared to white people, white women.
And I would imagine promulgated those myths too, right? Okay. I mean, that's the thing, is that it's not, that allows him to experiment on these women. But the fact that he experimented on these women also then sort of promote that idea. I mean, there's a lot I want to get to, but we're not going to have time. But tell us about Premarin. Let's jump ahead, I guess, almost 150 some odd years or so into the mid to late 20th century. What is Premarin?
The Premarin was one of the first estrogen supplements that was, so it was a sort of precursor to what we would now know as kind of hormonal estrogen therapy, what we call HRT, hormone replacement therapy in the UK. And it was called Premarin because it was made from mare's urine. So it was crystallized estrogen, synthetic estrogen that was, synthesized estrogen taken from the urine of female horses. So that's where it gets its smashing name from. And it was developed after sort of years of theorizing about hormones that began with ideas about internal secretions that emerged in the later 19th century, when, you know, the earliest theories about hormones were developed by gynecologists and endocrinologists who were trying to isolate what the essence of femininity was, what the essence of masculinity was. And before they knew to call these essences hormones, they called them internal secretions. So by the time Premarin was developed, there was a real race to sort of isolate these essences, you know, and by that time they knew what they were, you know, testosterone, estrogen. And estrogen had already taken on, you know, all the characteristics that we have associate with it now, that it is a feminizing, that, you know, it stabilizes women's emotions, that without estrogen we are, you know, cantankerous and unruly. And Premarin being the first of those, you know, it's pretty swiftly rushed to market and very popular. And it was really emerged onto market with a real narrative about how women, when they were, you know, drip fed chemical femininity, that they would be pleasing, that they would be, you know, affectionate and quiet and docile, and that they would, you know, be happy in the feminine role of mother, of wife, of, you know. And of course, Premarin being a, you know, a drug associated with menopausal replacement, hormonal replacement, was associated with kind of leveling out the sort of cantankerous older wife. And honestly, some of the adverts for this stuff are just, you know, laughable, but also so enraging. You know, you have ads with like a woman proffering some party snacks and smiling, and her husband looking at her, you know, dotingly, and underneath it says, "Premarin, help keep her this way." You know, so it was really couched in this kind of narrative of, you know, you want a pleasant wife, you want a wife who's agreeable, drip feed her chemical femininity. So that's what Premarin was. And of course, hormone replacement therapy, along with the other history's other major estrogen supplement being the contraceptive pill, were then mired in, you know, lack of research, lack of transparency around side effects, and became real sort of hotbeds for especially feminist health activists when campaigning in the mid 20th century to, you know, for medical transparency, to be told the truth about what they were taking. So we've got, you know, medicine again is trying to invent this medicine to correct a problem that essentially it created, which is the idea that women just kind of become sort of, you know, domestically and kind of useless the minute they childbearing day's over.
When you hear it like that ad, I guess is what really stuck out for me, was, you know, 60 years ago. And like, it's not, you know, it's just, that's pretty deeply embedded in our culture. That's pretty stunning. All right, with just a minute or two left, where are we now? I mean, you know, at one point you cite the Marie Curie Hospital. I guess that was in the early 1900s, I think that was. That was having a lot of success in terms of cancer relative to what the success rate was for cancer. And that was an all-women's run hospital. And now I think we're at like 37% of doctors are women, and that's changing the nature of medicine. In just a minute, where would you say we are at this point in this sort of very, very slow evolution of medicine?
I think we're at a reckoning with the cultural reckoning with this issue. I think we are coming to understand how systemic this issue is. I think we're beginning to treat it as a legitimate issue. I think for a long time, the treatment of women by the medical establishment has gone unchecked. You know, it's a system of power that has gone mainly unchecked. I think we're now in a reckoning with it, in which, you know, we have got more interest in the press. We're having more sociological studies into what bias means and how that affects people's health. And as you say, we're having, you know, an increase in women within the medical profession. And also now I believe that women in both UK and US medical schools slightly outnumber men in entry to medical schools. So I feel like we're in the midst of a reckoning, much overdue, but we also hopefully are sitting on the kind of precipice of a systemic change where implementable strategies that really do address these blind spots, these neglects, these kind of mistakes of the past. And they need to be addressed with systemic change that comes from funding, that comes from women's health issues being prioritized at the top level of research, and also with, you know, development of implementable strategies so that these mistakes of the past aren't just repeated, you know, ad infinitum, and that across the whole of a woman's life cycle, you know, her relationship to her body and her understanding of what's going on in her body should really be respected in its entirety. And that's going to take systemic as well as cultural change. You know, women from the grassroots up can do a lot, you know, to draw attention, but we also need the system to change too. And hopefully, I can only hope that it will.
Eleanor Cleghorn, the book is Unwell Women, Misdiagnosis and Myth in a Man-Made World. Thank you so much for your time today. We'll put a link to that at majority.fm.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, folks, quick break, and then we'll be back to wrap it up. We are back and just wrapping up the show for those folks who are watching us on Peacock. Thanks for joining us. And we will see you again tomorrow.
Yes.
And for those of you sticking around, I can't get over, like, when you hear like an ad like that, and I mean, aside from all the other horror stories we heard, but when you hear like an ad like that, like that ad probably aired close, if not while I was alive.
Just think
I'm
about-
old, all right? But
yeah.
I'm not that old. And the idea that like, it just...
I was also just thinking about some of the practices of... with which, you know, women would essentially be knocked out with hallucinogens when giving birth in the 50s and 60s. I mean, it's like the body is a vehicle for child creation, and any kind of complications are defective and met with scorn. And I will say, my mother had cancer, and some of these, I'm going to get her this book because I think she would really empathize with her breast cancer. Some of the way she was treated in terms of how doctors reacted to when she was experiencing certain things. So definitely a real phenomenon and stuff I've experienced. I once had to see a male OBGYN, and I mean, it's not, I like, men can be good OBGYNs, but it's harder, I would say. It's harder.
I also would imagine that this dynamic extends to, like, even, I would imagine, to, like, the psychology profession and psychiatry yes. profession in terms of, like, a medication. I would also imagine it is not just gendered, and she does, you know, delve into the particular sort of challenges that the medical establishment has in regards to black women. But one stat that stuck out for me, and I wonder now what all the things were behind it, is that prior there was apparently insurance rates for black folk was much lower than white folk in this country. At least the health insurance rates. And early data showed that there were far less overdoses amongst black people when it came to opiates in the wake of, like, the OxyContin issue, because they didn't have the health insurance to get the pain medication to get addicted to. Right. And I'm not convinced, too, that there isn't a dynamic there where the doctors were like, well, you're not really in pain, so we're not going to give you the oxy. I would imagine that that's complete speculation on my part as to it, but I would imagine that may have played a role as well.
I mean, there's a 2016 survey of 222 white medical students and residents found that half of them endorse at least one myth of physiological differences between black people and white people, including that black people's nerve endings are less sensitive than white people's. This is from the New York Times Magazine. And I mean, I was trying to find this because I couldn't remember. This is insane. Yeah. A third of these doctors to be also still believe the lie that Thomas Hamilton tortured John Brown to prove nearly two centuries ago that black skin is thicker than white skin. So there are a third of doctors entering into the profession, medical students, that believe black people's skin is thicker than white skin.
I mean, that's terrifying.
They're like, doctors are in our society as seen as unimpeachable, right? But they are subject to all...
They're human!
They're human, and also there's limitations, and when you think of... things from, like, this perspective that's in, you know, I think quite narrow of Western medicine in many ways.
Well, there you go, folks. We're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half. Just a reminder, it is your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, don't forget, JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off of that coffee. Fair trade, they're a movement partner over at Just Coffee. And we should also say the results are in. I have made a commitment to the Sun's Out, Guns Out.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I'm going to do it this Friday, fun half.
You keep pushing it off.
Well, There's a controversy.
Why?
Because Ronald Reagan, who folks who listen to the program know, he's this bully who bullies me around.
He like tortures you, actually.
Well,
too.
I don't want to say that.
Like,
I don't want
to overstate it to your Steven Crowder.
Yeah, exactly.
He was, I mean, sending Sam 100 cookies when we know what his issues are.
It's a bully thing, right?
No, that's torture.
It's a bully thing. Yeah, or torturous,
I'm going
torturous bully.
Yeah,
and so he sent a shirt, and I'm not sure where it is. It's not inconceivable at different times that it may have. I don't know. It's lost in the office. And he originally was the first one to do the Sun's Out, Guns Out. Now, I was intimidated by him and felt like I was being bullied too much. And then I made that deal with the audience about if they bought a certain amount of tank tops. I didn't think tank tops were that popular. So I thought I was sort of safe.
Well, some people like to show their guns.
Also, people are ready to get outside this summer.
I guess so.
Because the sun's out, so the guns are out.
We've sold 100 tank tops. I don't know what the black and the white ones. I don't know what the breakdown is. And so I said foolishly that I would wear one. I would do the sun's out, guns out on the fun half for the show. And then, my bully, my personal bully, starts to threaten me about wearing his shirt. So I may have to wear multiple shirts during the show. So it'll be involving, I'll have to get up, I'll have to walk, go into the changing room that we have here.
The bathroom.
Well, we have a changing room, too, for specifically for things like this.
Okay, the bathroom.
It was a huge waste of construction costs to build a changing room just for the one or two instances every 3 or 4 years that something like this happens.
But yeah.
I felt it was important.
Doubles as an old equipment room.
Yeah, exactly.
That's where my hologram server's housed.
Anyways, I'm not sure what the point of that was. Go to the merch shop, shop.majorityreportradio.com. We also, I think we still have a few left of the, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare shirts.
You don't want to wear the tank top for the Peacock show?
I mean, maybe. Maybe I will. We'll see. I mean, I actually think there might be a problem with the logo, but if I wear a non-logoed one, maybe I could get away with
it. The Raygun one, yeah.
Although, we have a logo right here. I don't know why that would be an issue. I can't say anything about the merch store. I can't explain why I'm wearing it. That's the only thing. I could do it. I could explain during the middle. Yeah, maybe I will.
Just say, I think I look good in this.
It's sun's out, guns out. What are you talking about? All right. Matt, what's happening in the Matt Lekkian media universe?
Well, tonight, for Left Reckoning patrons only, David Griscom and I are doing a think tank, so if you want to get your questions into that, join patreon.com/leftreckoning. And then we have some more fun stuff coming up later this week. We got Victor Poggi talking about Brazil and Lula and Bolsonaro and this sort of COVID vaccine kerfuffle he's got going on. And we'll also be talking to Andrew Hartman about the history of culture war. Very interesting book he wrote. We'll be talking about him. That might be a members only thing too, but probably released for everyone. So patreon.com/leftreckoning.
Okay, see you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
No. Are you ready?
Oh, yeah. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back, boy is back, and the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back, boy is back, and the alpha males are back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare.
Can you bring back DJ Dinner?
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Dinner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych, fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay. I'm making stupid money. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back. And the Africans are black.
black African, and the alpha males are black, 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 and the Africans are back, 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 back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keeping it 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them. Fuck them. Things I do for the bigger game plan. By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are back, back.
Come on! To pay the price of blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy.